Three people have been killed in a knife attack at a church in Nice in the south of France in what the city's mayor has described as a terrorist incident. We'll have the latest for you. The identity of a former US government official who penned a controversial anonymous opinion piece on Donald Trump's presidency in the New York Times in 2018 is revealed. And before the end of the programme, we'll assess a new exhibition in Germany, which asks how the legendary US civil rights activist Angela Davis became a figurehead in East Germany during the Cold War. Monocle's editors and correspondents take on those stories today here on the Late Edition on Monocle 24. Hello there and a very warm welcome to you to the Late Edition here on Monocle 24. It is Thursday, the 29th of October, and I'm Thomas Lewis here in Toronto. And joining us today to discuss the day's top news stories from around the world are Monocle 24's Carlotta Ribello, who is at Midori House in London, and Henry Rees-Sheridan, who is in New York City for us. Thank you to the two of you for being with us today. Well, before we hear from Carlotta and from Henry, let's begin in France, where three people have been killed during a knife attack inside a church in the southern city of Nice. The city's mayor, Christian Estrosi, has described it as a terrorist attack, and in response, France's national state of alert has been raised to its highest level. Monocle's news editor, Chris Chermak, is monitoring the story for us from London, and he joins us now. Chris, what do we know so far?
Hello, Thomas. Yes, France is once again in mourning tonight after three people were killed by a man wielding a knife at the Notre-Dame Basilica in Nice, as you say. The attack was actually one of three possibly Islamist-related incidents today. One man in Avignon who was carrying a knife and threatening passersby was shot by police. Another man was arrested for attacking a guard at France's embassy in Saudi Arabia. Now, all of this, of course, has put France on high alert, just as the country is also entering a second lockdown due to the coronavirus pandemic. French President Emmanuel Macron was in Nice earlier today. Let's listen to a bit of what he had to say.
Si nous sommes attaqués, une fois encore, c'est pour les valeurs qui sont les nôtres, pour notre goût de la liberté, pour cette possibilité sur notre sol de croire librement et de ne céder à aucun esprit de terreur. Et je le dis avec beaucoup de clarté une fois encore aujourd'hui, nous n'y céderons rien.
Emmanuel Macron there essentially saying that France has been attacked for its values and stressing that the country would never give in to terrorism. He also placed France on its highest terrorist alert level and said that more than 4,000 additional soldiers would be deployed to guard schools and churches. Now, these attacks, of course, mark another major escalation after Macron issued a robust defense of secularism and free speech. That was following the killing just 2 weeks ago of a school history teacher, Samuel Paty, who showed his students the magazine Charlie Hebdo's controversial cartoons depicting the Prophet Muhammad. Now, Macron's words back then prompted boycotts of French products in parts of the Islamic world, condemnations from some Muslim leaders, most notably Turkey's President Erdogan, who attacked Macron's mental well-being. That prompted a major diplomatic row between the two countries. So one notable difference after today's attacks is that foreign leaders, including in the Muslim world, have come to France's defense. Turkey's foreign ministry condemned the attack, and Iran's foreign minister issued a statement strongly condemning the terrorist attack in Nice and also calling for an end to the, quote, cycle of provocations and violence. Also notable is that the French Muslim Council issued a statement calling on Muslims to cancel Maulid celebrations in response to the attack. So, Thomas, I'd say it's worth highlighting such moderate responses now more than ever if France and the Islamic world are to find some way out of this ongoing crisis. Back to you.
Chris Chermak, Monocle's news editor, thank you very much indeed. And we will be monitoring the ongoing investigation in France here on Monocle 24. But next here on the Late Edition, there are 5 days to go before Election Day in the United States. And yesterday, another twist in the race in these closing days was offered up by Miles Taylor, a former official within the US Department of Homeland Security, who revealed himself to be the anonymous author of a controversial opinion piece published by the New York Times in 2018. That piece memorably claimed that there were figures within the White House who were intervening in small, quiet, but nonetheless consequential ways to thwart the more sporadic parts of Donald Trump's unpredictable approach to the presidency. There had been huge speculation as to the identity of the author. Taylor himself was asked about it by the CNN news anchor Anderson Cooper in late August.
There was an op-ed, there was a book by someone calling themselves Anonymous. Are you aware of who that is?
I'm not. Look, and that was a parlor game that happened in Washington, D.C., of a lot of folks trying to think of who that might be. I've got my own thoughts about who that might be, but, I want my focus to be on the president, and I certainly don't want to. I wear a mask for two things, Anderson, Halloweens and pandemics, so no.
Miles Taylor there speaking to CNN in August, who was in fact wearing a mask because it was in fact him who did write that anonymous op-ed and the book that followed. Henry, just remind us if you could, given just how huge the speculation has been over the past few years since the op-ed first was published, why this was such a massive story within Washington circles and what this revelation by Miles Taylor, that it was him who wrote it, what that all means now.
Well, when the op-ed was published, the first reason why it was so contentious was obviously its incendiary content. The claim that was being made in the op-ed, which readers only knew was written by a high-ranking Trump official, is that many officials working within the Trump administration were working to actually undermine the president and deflect the impact of his worst impulses on the nation and the national well-being, which is obviously itself a kind of pretty dramatic claim to be made. And then secondly, there were ethical questions pertaining to the publication of this op-ed. So first of all, was it cowardly for the author to level accusations of incompetence and immorality at the president from behind the cover of anonymity? But also, was it unethical for the New York Times to publish an op-ed anonymously out of concern merely that the author might lose their job? Publishing anonymously, it has been done before by the Times, but by undocumented immigrants or when the op-ed is being published by a Syrian refugee. So people whose well-being would be quite straightforwardly endangered by the revealing of their identity. In this case, it wasn't clear that there was such a compelling case to be made for protecting the identity of the author, and so that fed into the contention.
And Carlotta, to come to you on this, the reaction to Miles Taylor's unveiling of himself yesterday has been pretty stark, pretty angry in some quarters, particularly from the Trump administration. What do you make of some of the threads that Henry touched on there that have now borne out, if you like, in this reaction to the fact that we know who wrote those anonymous pieces from within the White House?
Especially when we look at the reaction from within the White House and Trump's administration / campaign to this, it is not surprising. You know, we've grown accustomed over the past 3.5 years of his presidency to hear him call people liars, even when we know the facts. So the fact that the line coming out of the White House immediately was that he was a two-faced liar as he was playing both sides of the game is not surprising at all. I believe as well, former Trump aide Kellyanne Conway also came out saying, you know, this is just speculation game ahead of the vote so close to the election. Now, one thing I would say, though, is there was also reaction from, you know, not Republicans, I'll just broaden it up like that, saying that, you know, as impactful as it was, this op-ed that was published back then in 2018, they kind of were expecting it to be someone higher up in, let's call it, a food chain that is the White House, basically not viewing Miles Taylor to have enough importance for this to cause enough ripples to change the outcome of the election. Now, I personally don't think this alone can change anything. I don't think the fact that he has revealed himself now will change someone's mind on how they are going to vote. But it is good that, you know, all these claims that we've heard over the past few years about how things are badly done within the White House, how Trump is out of control and there's this group of people trying to basically steer him into the right direction, or at least steer him away from the direction he wants to go, it's nice to at least know those people exist, you know? And I don't know if I'm making sense when I say that, but as powerful as an anonymous op-ed it can be, there is, of course, another level of gravitas as soon as you know that you can put a name to the article.
Well, elsewhere in the US election race today, both Donald Trump and Joe Biden are in Florida, the state where the race appears to be closest of all of those underway in the key swing states, which could ultimately decide the election result. Those rallies take place as early voter turnout continues to break records. More than 78 million ballots have already been cast, according to the latest estimates. That's more than half of the total number of votes cast in the 2016 presidential election. Carlotta, Donald Trump won Florida last time around, in part thanks to support from senior voters, which make up a significant proportion of the population in several parts of Florida. As a bloc, they appear to be moving away from the president this time around, according to the latest opinion polls. But Donald Trump does appear to be making gains with perhaps unlikelier voter groups.
Yes, we have been seeing that. And, you know, when it comes to senior voters, the justification that a lot of analysts are saying is because of the current pandemic, whether we like it or not, COVID-19 has really shaped the way this campaign has been held. As much as candidates have tried to deviate from it and talk about other issues, it really is dominating that. The Trump campaign saying how the failings of Joe Biden, and Joe Biden trying to point out Trump's mishandling of the whole pandemic. And that is a key indicator of why senior voters might be moving away from that, because it is the age group that has been most impacted by COVID-19, whether be it by being more at risk or having to isolate properly, all of these factors that have to be counted in. Now, there is, of course, as well, the latest polls indicating that young black voters might be inching toward Trump, which might be surprising, especially if we consider the momentum of the Black Lives Movement demonstrations that have been happening for the past few months. That might be surprising. And it is, I don't know, how I really don't was trying to figure out why that might be. Might it just be because of the people that were asked in this particular case? But I wasn't able to find a definite answer to why some more surprising groups were edging towards Trump. You mentioned there early voting, and I think it's quite astonishing. I know here we were talking about Florida, but Texas is a state that is up for grabs now, which is quite impressive. And as of a few hours ago, they've already have an early voting. 91% of the same amount of people have voted in total of last year. So I do think that the key and the defining factor of this election is going to be voter turnout. People are heading to the polls as it hasn't seen before. Early voting is off the charts. We still have actual election day to go through. Turnout is going to be so decisive. And in a way, it is inspiring and amazing to see so many people wanting to be involved in this process.
And Henry, just a final thought to you on this. What do you make of this slightly mercurial shift in how people are voting this time around?
I mean, in terms of the specific campaigning strategies of the two candidates, I remember reading a quote about the nature of the evaluation of campaigns, where the day after the election, the team behind the winning candidate are all geniuses and every decision they made was the right one, and the team behind the losing candidate didn't make a single right decision over the course of the whole election campaign. And I think it's quite difficult to accurately evaluate. Well, actually, kind of impossible to really quantify the impact of, you know, particular candidates visiting particular states at particular times on voter turnout. So I'm not sure how helpful it is to kind of ruminate on the potential impact of that. But one shift that I do find interesting in considering the future of the Republican Party beyond Trump, And it's something which I think you flagged up earlier was the orientation of Hispanic voters, particularly younger immigrants from Cuba, who are disproportionately concentrated in Florida towards a Republican Party, which, given the importance of Florida as a swing state, could shore up Republican electoral chances on the presidential level for some time to come. Obviously, that's fueled by a longstanding antipathy towards Democratic concessions towards the Castro regime. But to see that kind of being passed down from generation to generation is interesting and something that I'm sure Republican strategists are going to be keeping their eyes on.
Well, there are only 5 days to go before Election Day in the United States, and we will be following every twist and turn in these closing days of the campaign here on Monocle 24. But finally, here on today's programme, let's turn to an exhibition that is currently underway in the German city of Dresden, the starting point for which is the US civil rights figure Angela Davis, whose activism in the 1970s made her a figurehead for the racial justice movement in the United States. It was speeches like the one from August 1969 that we're about to hear a small part of now that made her an icon to many, not only in the United States, but elsewhere too. Here now is part of Angela Davis's address to students at the University of California, Los Angeles, speaking after the withdrawal of her teaching position at the university, where she was also working on her PhD at the time, in the wake of her activism.
We have to ask ourselves whether we're going to make an effort now towards individual fulfillment, or whether we're going to wage a fight for a more humane society. Whether we're going to create a strong defensive against what may very well become an era of fascism. You see, I don't think we really have a choice. I don't think there is any question about what the priority should be. I think the priority is very clear. Because, and this is the last thing I want to say, because if we don't work to prevent the full-blown development of fascism in this country, then we won't even be able to talk about, individual fulfillment in the future. Thank you very much.
Angela Davis speaking there in August 1969, words that resonate now as much as they did when she spoke them. Well, the new exhibition, 1 Million Roses for Angela Davis, chronicles in part how she became a state-sponsored icon in East Germany during the Cold War. Henry, this isn't a part of Angela Davis's history that I was aware of before reading about this exhibition. Could you chronicle for us as best as you can how she became this totemic figure in East Germany back at the height of her activism in the 1970s?
Yeah, I didn't know about it either. Basically, from 1970 to 1972, just over a year within that period, Angela Davis was being held in a California jail on charges of conspiracy, murder and kidnapping. And during this time, basically, I think along the principle of the enemy of my enemy is my friend, the East German state coordinated a massive campaign for its citizens to send hundreds of thousands of postcards to Davis while she awaited trial. And a selection of these postcards, which were sent from a very broad selection of the East German populace, from kind of children to the heads of workers' groups, formed the backbone of this exhibition in Dresden. And this was only really the kind of a start of her relationship with East Germany. After she was released, she was invited to East Germany as a state guest and was greeted by 50,000 people at Schönefeld Airport in Berlin. And over the course of the 70s, she also had a cozy relationship with the USSR, who was, as I mentioned, keen to support an antagonist of the American state. So she had very close relations with the Eastern Bloc throughout that decade.
And Carlotta, you've been taking a look at why a figure of resistance, the leader of a movement in one place, sometimes becomes a figurehead for whatever reason somewhere else. What crossed your path? What caught your eye?
Well, so I was trying my best to get away from the obvious answer. When you look at protest movements around the world in modern times, it usually there's always a Che Guevara somewhere, isn't it? It seems to be the revolutionary figure that people identify most with this idea of going against the regime, which also prompts another discussion about the misuse of his image, but we'll leave that to another day. It made me think about Portugal and a few of other revolutionaries or rebels who I've seen across protests in the country. And one that has always fascinated me, and I think that's when I found out about her for the first time, this is, I guess, at the end of my high school years or maybe first year of university, is Rosa Luxemburg, you know, who helped the leftist insurgency in Germany and, you know, became part of the German Communist Party. And often in Portugal, we see references to her still today. Portugal, of course, had its own revolution against a fascist regime that happened in 1974. There are still a few things named after Rosa Luxemburg in my country because of her significance in history. There's also one other thing, going away from people, but I would like to also mention gestures that kind of seem to become universal signs of protest movement across borders. I remember stumbling upon a photo from the 1960s in the United States, some peaceful protesters against the Vietnam War. And the photo was this young man putting flowers on the barrel of a gun from one of the armed forces. And I remember being surprised because I've always associated that with the revolution in my country. You know, the revolution in Portugal is called the Carnation Revolution, famously because there was no violence, because this woman who was selling flowers decided to starting to put carnations in the military's and also the opposition arms. And that's why we never had any violence. And I always associated that movement with Portugal in 74, and then seeing it that it happened, you know, a decade earlier somewhere in the US. I doubt it was the inspiration because we were under a dictatorship, so I don't think people would have had access to that photo. But it's kind of this instinctive way to signify and signal your protest and opposition to something that crosses all borders. And that is quite incredible.
Well, Carlota Rebello and Henry Rees-Sheridan, our very own revolutionary heroes in their way here at Monocle 24. That's all we have time for today's programme. A big thanks to you both for being with us today. Our studio manager today was Steph Chungu in London. A big thanks to her, as always, too. The Late Edition returns at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Tomos Lewis, here in Toronto, thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow.